It was Wesley Clark who said that, you know, we need an America where debate and dissent and questioning your leaders and holding them accountable is the highest form of patriotism. And it was J. William Fulbright who said that in a democracy, dissent is an act of faith. And it was Ari Fleischer who said that people have just got to watch what they say and do. Thanks again. America is a 57 Chevy that veers to the left and lurches to the right. America is a pawn shop window with decals of Old Glory made by children in China. America is a dog playing poker, saying war is a last resort and wagging his tail. America is a compassionate conservative and a gay Republican and a vegetarian vampire. America is that Norman Rockwell of a family on Thanksgiving hung on the wall of an Indian casino. America is a big group therapy session with one guy in the corner who will not shut up. God bless the firefighter. God bless the video clerk. And God bless America. It just might work. A Japanese fiddler in Branson, Missouri, doing Louis Armstrong. America is a scholarly discussion of the socioeconomic implications of Janet Jackson's boob. Came up to you and said, I'm going to bring forth on this nation a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. You'd probably say, right on, good luck with that. And what if you said, I'm going to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity? Probably say, wow, knock yourself out. And what if he said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. You'd probably say, I got a meeting. America is a conspiracy of genius in sweat-stained waistcoats and powdered wings. America is a homeless Jesus being held at gunpoint by King James. America is an apple pie with a few bad apples right toward the top. America is a dream of freedom dreamed by everyone all over the world. With liberty and justice for all. That's nuts. Yeah, it just might work. America
thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program, George Packard on America's Unwinding. George Packard talks to Tom Ashbrook about a great American era coming to an end, the era of a strong middle class, and we're all in this together. George Packard is a writer at The New Yorker and an author of the new book, The Unwinding, an Inner History of the New America. And that's followed by the commencement address by comedian Stephen Colbert. And then after that, Barack Obama's 2004 Democratic National Convention keynote speech.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you were born in 1960 or after, you have lived in a great age of American unwinding, writes my guest today, George Packard. An age of once-honored institutions and assumptions coming apart. It can be bewildering, give you vertigo. It can feel like the end of America, the beginning of something new and unsettling. Packer's gone deep on it, on us. This hour, On Point, George Packard on the unwinding of America. Later in this hour, comedian Stephen Colbert tells the graduating class at the University of Virginia, you owe the previous generation nothing. We'll listen in. But first, joining me now from New York is George Packard, staff writer at The New Yorker. Packard takes on big issues. He's author of The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq, and Interesting Times, Writings from a Turbulent Decade. His new book is The Unwinding, an Inner History of the New America, he calls it. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. George Packard's been called our modern-day George Orwell. Kirkus Reviews calls The Unwinding a foundational document in the literature of the end of America. You don't read that every day. George Packard, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you here.
And it's great to be back with you, Tom.
This is quite a book. People are comparing it to John Dos Passos, USA, a big trilogy, kind of in some ways a pastiche of, many lives here, some ordinary in the great and small sense of the word, some celebrity. But begin to introduce us, George. What is The Unwinding?
You described it well, Tom, at the beginning. I wanted to create a portrait of the country as it has changed in my adult lifetime, rather arbitrarily taking 1978 as a point of departure. I think what's happened over the last generation is certain institutions that used to support the aspirations of ordinary people didn't guarantee that everyone was going to make it or be the same, but supported the dreams of ordinary people and gave them the sense of having a place in the larger society, have begun to corrode and even to collapse. We could go through them one after another, but they're not a secret. Government, business, banking, the media, schools, all the key institutions that supported middle-class life in the period from, say, the 30s to the 70s, which you could call the Roosevelt Republic, mm-hmm. about a half a century in which America was truly a middle-class democracy, obviously excluding some groups, many groups. Women were second-class citizens during that time. Blacks were third-class citizens. Yep. But the country had the institutions that could correct themselves. It had the ability to widen the circle of opportunity, and it did, and it began to do that in the 60s and 70s. But simultaneously with that widening of opportunity has come this contraction where the middle class has been hollowed out. And many of the people who might have benefited from the inclusiveness of our generation, the greater inclusiveness, mm-hmm. have actually seen their fortunes diminish and even drop down to the bottom. So this strange parallel phenomenon of greater tolerance, greater openness, greater freedom. I mean, freedom is the bottom line for the era we live in. It
so
underlines
far.
Everything. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's always threats to it, and they come from both the government and from the Facebooks of our world to our privacy. But
and from ennui and disillusionment and maybe disarray sometimes. But anyway, yeah.
that can undermine it too. I'd say what we've traded is we've gotten more freedom. We've given up more security. And all you have to do is travel to any small town or old industrial city or rural area around the country and find the cost of that trade and how it's hurt ordinary people and how they feel they're alone, that those structures that used to support their dreams are no longer there and they have to make their own way. And that's the story I wanted to tell through the characters who are at the heart of The Unwinding.
You can listen to Great Speeches and Interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, we now take you behind the scenes to the Middle East peace negotiations, where the UN negotiator has just introduced Yasser Arafat to Benjamin Netanyahu. The negotiator was overheard to say, "Yasser, that's my Bibi." Here comes Mr. Netanyahu now.
I just met with Mr. Arafat. We met man to man, eye to eye, knee to groin. And I said, we have a no deal, have a no deal, have a no deal, Israel will save. Hamas, Mubarak, Hamas, Mubarak, Hamas, Mubarak, Arafat, go shave. Assad, don't run around, Assad, don't run around, Assad, don't run around, we are after peace. Saddam, Iraqi Scud, Saddam, Iraqi Scud, Saddam, Iraqi Scud, your head we will crease. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Netan.
Netanyahu.
I'm Netanyahu.
Yahoo hoo.
Come on, you know who.
Who are you?
My name is BB.
You give me the hippie jibby.
Yahoo hoo. Yahoo hoo.
Could be BB.
Yahoo! You've gone so deep in these lives, some, again, ordinary, others, big celebs are sort of modern-day Gatsbys as you present them, Oprah and Jay-Z and Newt Gingrich and Peter Thiel, the PayPal co-founder, Silicon Valley guy. I mean, we're thinking about ordinary people, all kinds of people in Oklahoma today with this big tornado coming down on them. I was thinking
Absolutely.
As I watched the coverage of that, how, and this related, tied into your book somehow, we tend to see things as end times signals these days. I quoted Kirkus, you know, they read your book, and you talk about, George, the hollowing out of the middle class. We've been talking about that for decades now. But they read The Unwinding, and they talk about a foundational document in the literature of the end of America. Why do you think people are feeling that way about this?
I don't know that it's the end of America. It may be the end of America as we've known it. You know, one way to see this is there are these periodic periods of upheaval and of radical change and transformation. The period right after the founding of the country was one such. The Civil War was another. The crash of 29 and the Great Depression was a third. And in each case, the country found a way to create new structures that continued to make it a democracy that included larger and larger numbers of people in opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't figured out how to do that. Some people think the internet is the answer, that, you know, social networking is a new form of value, and that if you don't have a job or you don't make a lot of money, you still have, you know, your friends on Facebook or on Twitter. And I'm very skeptical. I don't think the internet has replaced the industries that supported middle class life. It's made a few people very rich. You can read about it on the front page of the New York Times today. Two very interesting headlines. Billions in taxes avoided by Apple,
yep.
Which reminds us that Silicon Valley, after all, is just another industry with self-interested corporations. And then the story of Tumblr being sold to Yahoo, which is, again, a kind of winner-take-all jackpot in which a young man with a brilliant idea becomes a multi-millionaire in his 20s. Has it created real value for the majority of people across the country? Not yet. Will it? I don't know. But that's the darkness that's at the, you know, sort of on the margins of my book. I don't think my story is an entirely dark story, and I hope we'll talk about the characters at the heart of it because they are the things that give me some hope.
Well, I want to give us a quick intro of each of them and the celebs. You've got Oprah in here and Jay-Z and Bob Rubin, who was Treasury Secretary and so high in Citigroup, so much to do with the deregulation era. And Newt Gingrich, how did you decide, how did you pick your everyman characters? How did you pick your celebs and why, George?
Well, let's start with the celebs. You mentioned those pastas, and he was kind of a model for me. I love the USA trilogy. It's not much read anymore, but it's a fantastically inventive way in fictional form to tell the history of the early 20th century in America. I picked celebrities from different institutions and walks of life. Newt Gingrich, to me, represents everything that's gone wrong with politics in the last generation. He will be remembered as maybe even more important than Bill Clinton.
You write of his colleagues, he gave them mustard gas, the sort of deadly politics, and they used it on every conceivable enemy, including him.
Including him. He in the end, was was cannibalized by the revolutionaries he brought into Congress. Yeah, he created the politics of absolute bitter polarization, of using language to demonize the opponent into an enemy. Even the politics of big money, he profited from that greatly. So Newt Gingrich is a seminal figure in our politics. Robert Rubin, you know, decent man, brilliant
Well, you take him down a notch
guy,
and a half.
But he represented Wall Street and Washington in a period of ever-widening inequality, and his policies really in the end didn't do anything to mitigate that. And at the end of his career on Wall Street, he was making millions and millions of dollars while Citibank, Citigroup was about to nearly take the banking system down with it and turn to the public for essentially, you know, a bailout. So there's a quality, and Jay-Z is this fascinating figure. He comes from a housing project. He's a drug dealer, and then he just by sheer force of will and talent, and the will to win, rises up to the very top of music and clothing and sports. He's friends with presidents, and he's a great example of how without the normal structures, there's this sense among young people that you have to cut in line. You have to say, I'm not going to do the normal thing of holding down a steady job and slowly rising because that doesn't work anymore. I am going to force my way to the top by breaking the rules and maybe breaking the law. Mm-hmm. So all of these characters to me, these celebrity characters, different walks of life, Alice Waters in the area of food, Oprah Winfrey in television, Sam Walton in business, the founder of Walmart, they all in some ways represent institutions no longer working for ordinary people, and these people building their own empires, essentially from scratch in many cases. They're all coming out of very hard or obscure backgrounds and in the classic American way, reinventing themselves up to the top.
Kind of the Gatsbys of our time. And in this case,
exactly.
Stepping up on the rubble of institutions falling apart. If you feel vertigo, there's a reason for that in our country in recent decades, George Packer writes in his new book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. George, stand by in New York. Julia Klein in the Chicago Tribune says the whole book reminds her of a Springsteen song, maybe the Wrecking Ball album. He's behind us right here. Listeners, you can join us. Have you seen the America you know, we knew, drift away, become less equal, less hopeful, less knit together? What's going on? 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook with George Packer. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Gringo Hill, the Calvary stayed home. There ain't no one here in the bugle bone. We take care of our own. We take care of our own. Wherever this flag's flown.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New Yorker writer George Packer about the end of America as we've known it and maybe what comes next. His big new book is The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And we are thinking throughout as we talk today about everybody who's been hit so hard by that monster tornado in Oklahoma. We will look tomorrow at possibility of re-engineering Tornado Alley, or maybe impossibility, to deal with that kind of superstorm. Foundational document of the literature of the end of America is how Kirkus Reviews sees this new book, and it goes deep on lives that are coming undone. George, introduce us just a little to the ordinary folks who are at the heart of this book. You've got three of them up against three different maybe kinds of tides. Take us in.
Yeah, I wanted to find people whose lives sort of coincided with the period of the book, the past generation. So let's talk first about Dean Price, who's a guy about 50 years old in rural North Carolina, grew up in the Bible Belt tobacco country. His father was a preacher. His family had been tobacco farmers forever. Dean had the dream of being an entrepreneur. One of his heroes was Steve Jobs, and he started a chain of truck stops in his part of North Carolina and gradually found that he was just getting squeezed out by Sheetz and other national chains, by Walmart, by all the big box stores and the big oil companies. And he sort of had an epiphany. He would spend evenings sitting out on his front porch, which faced a highway, and he up the hill was the Bojangles that he owned. A fast food place. And he would hear the trucks rushing by in the dark. And he knew that some of them were carrying loads of chickens that were hormone fed, so overweight they couldn't walk, to the slaughterhouses. And those chickens would then come back up to his store, his Bojangles, where very disgruntled workers, not getting paid very much, would cook them into the food that was being sold. And he imagined their hatred of the work sort of seeping into the food. And they would sell it to local people who would eat this food and get very, very overweight because of the terrible diet that fast food food becomes. And in the end would, you know, have to be hospitalized, or would get diabetes, and would be forced to drive an electric wheelchair around the Walmart supercenter that was forcing him out of business.
We've all seen
like those hormone-fed chickens. Mm-hmm. And this sort of nightmare vision of his own region, which he loves and which is he's completely connected to, inspired him to try something new. And what he got into was biofuels and the idea of using canola seeds and even the waste oil from the very Bojangles and other restaurants that are scattered across the landscape to make diesel fuel for school buses so that the schools could save money because the schools are strapped for cash. And, you know, he hasn't made a killing off this. He still has the aspiration to be a great entrepreneur. This is his idea for how to resurrect the sort of fallen landscape of the Carolina Piedmont. And it's, to me, one of the sort of inspiring and just utterly American stories that you find as soon as you start traveling around outside the big cities and the coastal areas.
And yet it makes your heart ache. I mean, that, as you so beautifully put it, the hatred seeping into the food in that fast food restaurant and that fallen landscape that, you know, maybe he'll do something for it and maybe he won't. He's so off on his own. It can sound quite quixotic.
It is quixotic, and he's totally on his own. He's figuring this thing out by, you know, talking to his neighbors, by seeing what happened to his own business because of Walmart and other, you know, big chains, and by looking at the internet and picking up little bits of information from this blog or that website. And there are no, this is what we were talking about earlier, there are no structures that are supporting him. And he took me through the main street of the town he grew up in called Madison, North Carolina. And all we passed was one shuttered up pharmacy, restaurant, shoe store after another, just a couple of pedestrians on the sidewalks. And he told me the people who ran those stores were the pillars of this community. They were the Little League coaches. They were the town councilmen. They headed up the local civic groups. And once they lost their livelihood, the town lost its, you know, sort of the mainstays of life.
Yeah.
And imagine that happening in small towns across the country. It's not hard to find stories like this. And the Dean Prices, who are these essentially startup entrepreneurs inventing things kind of out of scratch and out of what's right around them, are, to me, the hopeful sign in this pretty bleak landscape.
Sorrow, sick of the pain, sick of hearing again and again that there's gonna be peace on earth where I grew up. Trees where the walls we tear them down and use them on our enemies. They say that what you mark will surely overtake you and you become a monster, so the monster will not break you. It's already gone too far. You said that if you're going hard, you won't get hurt. Jesus, can you take the time to throw a drowning man a line? Peace on earth. Tell the ones who hear no sound, whose sons are living in the ground. Peace on earth. Know who's the wise, no one cries like a mother cries for peace on earth. She never got to say goodbye, to see the color in his eyes, now he's in the dirt. Peace on earth. reading names out over the radio. All the folks the rest of us won't get to know. Sean and Julia, Gareth, Anne and Breda, their lives are bigger than any big idea. Jesus, can you take the time to throw a drowning man a line? Peace on earth. To tell the ones who hear no sound, whose sons are living in the ground. Peace on earth. Jesus, in the song you wrote, the words are sticking in my throat. Peace on earth. Hear it every Christmas time, but hope and history won't rhyme. So what's it worth? This peace on earth. Peace on earth. Peace on earth. Peace on earth.
And now for something completely different.